In this next 45 minutes or so, I want to look at different perspectives on addiction. And we want to, first of all, define addiction. We want to also look at maybe the many faces of addiction. But primarily today, I thought I might focus on the addiction of cyber sex. It's a hugely relevant topic at the moment, and that'll probably encompass most of the discussion. But we'll start off and we'll look at the general procedures of dealing with addiction. I sent out a little, yes, I can see it, a little printout. What I'm about to say has probably very little connection to that, although that's included. It just gets, the order and so on may get tossed around. There's a lot more involved than just that. That was something when they said, will you do it? And I said, oh, sure. They said, okay, send us an outline this afternoon. So that's what came up. And then since then, I've written what I want to say. So hopefully it's the same. So addictions come in many, many shapes and forms. So we really need to decide what is an addiction. Well, it goes to the idea of something that you actually surrender to, something that you are assigned to, something that in the vernacular just grabs you and it overpowers you. But I've tried to tease that out a little bit so that it's more applicable to more than one thing. Addiction is a repeated involvement with anything or anyone to satisfy an underlying need in spite of excessive cost. Now, you can see that that could be a positive thing. There can be positive addictions. I'm addicted to breathing. I really, you know, I'll just about do anything if I can continue to breathe. There you go. Well, that's not really an addiction. Well, it can be. Hopefully we're addicted to some other good things. You can be addicted, for example, to health food. You can be addicted to loving your wife. So addictions is something that you surrender to, that grabs you and overpowers you, and it has this repeated involvement as a key. And you could put in there compulsive involvement if you wanted to, but that does put a negative onto it. It also must meet an underlying need, and we'll talk about that because that's fairly controversial to say something like that when we're talking about addictions. An addiction can develop to a substance, a person, or an activity, but tends to develop with those to which there is an emotional attachment. Addictions basically are there to meet an emotional need, and it's usually met in an illegitimate way. So there are legitimate emotional needs, and we can meet them legitimately. But often when we try and meet legitimate needs illegitimately, they become addictive. Can I just have a look and see what you've got there? Because I suspect... No, okay, I didn't put this in. But you can have a positive addiction that can, you know, be something that's really good, you know, that's not even a harmful thing. In fact, it's a positive thing. You can have a habit that is a neutral habit. But both of those, if they shift to the negatives, they can become compulsive and addictive behaviours. So we need to know that we're talking about a spectrum, and we're going to be focusing upon those things where there's an emotional need that may be legitimate, but it's met in an illegitimate way. What are some of the basic emotional needs that we have as men? Emotional needs. Need to be loved. It's a big word. If we break it down, we might find there's even some other needs within that.
Security.
Security. We call that significance, yes? Self-esteem and significance.
Attention.
Attention, yeah.
Friendships.
Yeah. Yeah. Shelter, they're all good. Some of those can be clustered together and said that our basic need is a sense of belonging. And that probably, I mean, that fact is across males and females, that our key core need is to belong. And I think, you know, when we have the concept that our heart is in turmoil until we find our relationship with God. In other words, we find ourselves belonging to that or to whom we were created for. Let me go back on that. The faces of addiction. I just want to throw this open to you as to what are some of the addictions that you're aware of. Yeah, substances. They can be drugs. You can have substances that are kind of weird, but many kids are addicted to glue. You know?
Petrol.
Those sort of things. This one's okay, but...
I knew a bloke who was addicted to Coca-Cola.
Okay.
No, the real Coke, not cocaine.
No, that's why I put Coke on that. Okay, what? Gambling, sex, substances?
Pornography. Shopping.
Men, but okay. See, I maintain that men don't shop. Men purchase. Hey? Hey? You know what you want. You go in, you say, I've got that and that size, thank you. And you're gone.
I was
going to
say sports or television.
Okay, you can be addicted to sport. There's nothing wrong with that. That's one of those healthy ones. Particularly if you're a St. George supporter. Sorry.
Yes, there are.
Sorry.
Work addiction.
Workaholics, we used to call them, right? Yeah.
Image, labels, you know, clothing, hot cars, that sort of stuff.
Okay, let's call that fashion for a minute, but it's different. You know, yeah, Ford's a little different than a Gucci, but... yeah. What? Sorry?
Control.
Neil?
Neil? Damn right. It's an addiction.
And it can be very destructive. Okay, now, if we had time, what I'd like to do would be to go through and find out which of these addictions are related to what needs we have. You see? The need for power and control, for example, has a lot to do with what...
Georgie?
Didn't you say self-esteem?
No, I did.
Oh, sorry, I thought... Okay, the idea is self-esteem and significance. I want to be in control because it makes me feel like I'm alive and I'm truly a man and adds to my sense of self. Work. What's the need there? What's the basic need that we have if we become addicted to our work?
Ego, power, position.
Yeah, it's the same thing. Ego, power, position, significance. See? And porn, we're going to look at. You could say that that has a lot to do with power and control. That I can do it because I can and I want to and no one's going to stop me. Again, these are needs that have... these are basic needs that have many different faces. And then you factor in the fact we are in a fallen state, in a fallen world, these all ply into the fabric of our fallenness. So it can be a person. One thing we didn't put up there was relationships. You know, you can be addicted to a person as much as you can be to a thing. Okay, what drives the addiction? Well, this is the cycle. And of course, the big bit that's missing in there is demand for relief of what? What is it that we are driven to find the relief for?
The underlying emotional
need. It's the issue that drives these. The need to belong, the need to feel significant, the need to be in control, to be the one who has all of the power. And when those things aren't there, eventually, and particularly if they do go back into one's early life, and you'll find that if you ever talk with people that are severely addicted, that there are often deficits in their life that they've never been able to meet, and so these are poor substitutes for that which is really a legitimate need. When we talk about cyber sex in a few minutes, most of the guys that I work, yes.
I see them as two different things. I see what you're talking about. There is something in our brain.
Yeah.
An idea.
Yeah.
Whereas substance, it's a chemical thing.
And what does the chemical do? It dulls. It gives an anesthetizing effect to the brain. And therefore,
the driving force is...
Okay.
I've noticed that I've got a problem with coffee. And I just have to walk past someone or see someone drinking coffee and I want it.
Yeah.
But there's a difference between, you know...
Yeah, we're talking...
Sex, you know, it's an idea, you know, the power, you know, well...
When we talk about the two models, we'll talk about whether the physiological... dependency is primary or secondary. Okay. And I'm maintaining that this sets you up as a vulnerability to be have that physical dependency. If these weren't there, you wouldn't have the need to be involved. Because, you know, I mean, a lot of people drink coffee, a lot of them aren't addicted. What's the difference? See, I think it goes back to the bio-social, psychological aspects. Demand for relief. Something inside us says we need to have this pain, this hurt, this emptiness, whatever it is, fulfilled. We take on the addictive action. However, we find that there's an escalation that occurs because a dissatisfaction is usually what happens because it doesn't meet the core need, because it's an illegitimate way to meet a real need. So it's never going to do it properly. This means that we get into either an increased resolve to beat it ourselves or to find a greater dosage or a greater access to whatever it is we need. However, that continues around. All we end up is more pain because we add to the emotionality. We add to the guilt, we add to the shame, we add to the sense of worthlessness, we add to the sense of hopelessness, which then creates a deeper need for whatever it is. And so you have a spiraling effect. And it takes more and more and more to keep it going. And so that's why you end up, and particularly if it kicks into a physiological dependency. Even a relationship can end up in a physiological dependency when it takes on a whole new life within a person's thinking. You can actually get physically ill when you're wanting to be with somebody. Sometimes it's called love. Okay, now this is the debate that's going on. And it's been going on for a long time. Is an addiction, particularly alcohol and substance abuse, is that a disease? Well, there is one group of people, and they've had research going for a long time, that says that addiction is a chronic primary hereditary disease which progresses from an early physiological susceptibility to an addiction characterized by tolerance changes. In other words, you can tolerate this, but then you can find you can tolerate more, and so it keeps going up. Physiological dependence and loss of control. Now, for most people, this fits with the Alcoholics Anonymous, the usual medical and disease model. The history of that goes a long way.
Really heritable?
Sorry?
Hereditary.
Oh, in the disease model. It is, yeah, you have an alcoholic father, the chances are that you've got genes that are going to be heading towards you towards that. Makes you susceptible because you've got the gene.
But that's not necessarily growing up in that environment.
It's a different thing. No, hang on, that's another model. See, there is another model, see, that we'll look at, that talks about environment. But this one is the predominant model. And so addiction is considered to be a disease because it progresses. And it has this idea that you can be susceptible through the genetics. It took a big leap forward in the 70s when a number of insurance companies in the US gave insurance rebates for those who went for treatment for addictions, and it went into the medical annuals. The American Psychiatric Association put it in as a medical treatment, and so you could go and get medical treatment for alcohol, and they began using anabuse and so on in the 70s. This took off, and the treatment usually follows a traditional AA 12-step program. That's after detox. But the psychological symptoms are considered secondary to the physiological disease and not relevant to its onset. In other words, the issues of the psychological needs that arise because the person is the addict. Right? The medical model says you have the disease and then the psychological problems arise because you are an addict. The other model that's come about more recently is that addiction is a voluntary process, a behavior that is explained by individual psychological and environmental factors that lead to choices that are intended to relieve the underlying pain. These choices can often lead to physiological dependency. Now you can see that they're not compatible, and they're consequently you have competing treatment facilities, certainly different philosophies behind them. One says that the addict will exhibit these particular psychological and social problems, whereas this model says the psychological and emotional problems result in a person being the addict. It's important to understand the difference. I don't think you got that in there, do you?
No.
Oh, you do have that.
Yeah,
it's probably a little different. I've reworked it a couple of times. So recovery follows a combination of behavioral, cognitive and social strategies as well as the resolution of the underlying issues that initiated the addiction. So a person who is counseled through a disease model is going to be sent to detox. they're going to be put into an abstinence mode, they're going to be put into an AA process of going through 12 steps, part of which will help them work through what it is an underlying issue in one sense, but they see as a symptom. Whereas if you go through this recovery, the addiction is the symptom of the underlying issue. And so you're working on both of them at the same time. Otherwise, you have what we call symptom substitution, where you switch from one drug to another, unless you actually move into the areas trying to understand and resolve the issues. All right? So I thought I'd look at cyber sex as a current addiction. And it's probably one you don't get to look at a whole lot. But it's any form of sexual expression accessed through the computer or the internet. Look at that next statistic. That's a very, very disturbing statistic. I mean, you can get lots of statistics about how many pornographic websites there are, and there are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them, and every day those statistics change. But this one, I think, is most significant. That 6 out of 10 hits to the web are actually involved in some sort of meeting a sexual fantasy. Why is it so popular? It's accessible, it's private, most of it's free, so the cost isn't in financial dollars, but the cost is huge in relationship dollars, if you want to think of it in that way. The other disturbing factor is that there's very little difference between the Christian community and the non-Christian community. A number of surveys have been conducted. One of the largest hotel chains in the world has released some statistics that read something like this, that their adult TV channels are more called upon when their hotels are being used for residential Christian conventions, particularly when they have pastors' conference. Eh? Sorry?
Might be research.
Yeah, you might want to ask, why does it happen when they're at convention and not at home? But that's disturbing, you see. So as a Christian community, we're not immune from this. In fact, it may be the fact, because it's kind of forbidden fruit, that it's becoming more and more an issue. In fact, 30% now of my clientele are dealing with males involved with cyber sex and pornography, many of whom. Cyber sex, we go back. Oops, where'd we go? Any form of sexual expression accessed through the computer or the internet, in other words, it's coming through cyberspace. It's not, you know, it's pornography on the net. And it ranges from voyeurism, where they're just looking at pictures, right? Usually it's accompanied by masturbation. But now, of course, you can pay your money, you can get webcam, and you can actually have virtual sex with somebody on the net. You can connect to your own particular woman who has the camera in her room, there's one with your room, and you can talk and you can interact with each other sexually. That's a lot different than when I was growing up, we used to sneak a look at somebody's Playboy magazine, or we read D.H. Lawrence's, can't even think of it now, Lady Chatterley's Lover, you know. You used to hold it and it'd fall open, you know, and that was the thrill. Now, Lady Chatterley's just, you know, $25 away and a few minutes on the linking in. It's a huge difference. But that's what we're talking about. Oops, going the wrong way. So we're talking something that's very relevant, something that's pervasive even within the Christian community. And I think that the sooner we realize that this is a secret addiction that's white-anting our families and our faith, the sooner we can do something about it. Now, you don't have this. I think you've got the stages of change. Yeah. You might want to put in another word in there, because there, what you're going to look at there is the self-directed change. Changes that people, and we'll get to that in the stage of it. But look at this. The first stage of other-directed change, in other words, change that isn't something necessarily you want, is coercion. If you've ever been in the DNA industry, where you've been working with addicts, you know about a thing called an intervention, where you get the whole family and lots of their friends around, and you bring the addict in, and they tell the addict how the person's addiction is impacting them. And Dad, I want you to go and get help. Or Mum, you need to go to hospital. And there's external pressure applied. It can be like a minister who came to me last year, whose wife found him masturbating in front of the TV on a porn exchange, and she said, "You get help or I'm gone." That's coercion. That's when there's discovery. It's healthier if it's disclosure, where someone might go to the pastor and say, "Look, I'm really struggling with this." And they say, "Well, you need to get help." Starts with coercion. There's no nice way of saying it. Frankly, we don't want to give up our bad habits. We're certainly not wanting to give up our addiction, because there's needs that have to be met. And at that point, we don't see any legitimate way of having our needs met. Or we recognize it but say, it's too costly to do that. I'd rather get this cheap way. I don't have to have any emotional involvement, but it meets some emotional needs. After the coercion stage, there's compliance. Now, you know, you can get your kids to comply with you. Does it mean they're actually cooperative? No, they're complying. It's still other-directed. They follow directions. And these are the stages. There's coercion. Then after they've been in it, then they begin to be compliant, because the cost of not being compliant means the wife's going to leave. The elders are going to fire you. Your children are going to be totally disillusioned. And so people comply. After the programs have been worked, then it usually comes to where it's collaboration, where they become self-directed. Hey, my family hasn't rejected me. My church hasn't thrown me out. My friends have come around. I can work this with them. And I want to get this done for myself, not for the so I can avoid the consequences. I had a wife tell her husband not too long ago, don't do this for me. Do it for yourself, because I mightn't be here when it's done. You know? So you need to do this for yourself, for your long-term future. Whether I'm here or not, you need to get over this addiction. And that was pretty hard for him to swallow, but he realized that he needed to do it for himself because it's right. It's what God would want for him. Don't do it just so you're pleasing someone else. It's got to be self-directed. So when we're talking self-direction, that's when we bring in those stages that I've given you. The self-directed. This is when people are not sure they really want to give it up. They move through, well, what's the costs of giving it up versus what's the cost of maintaining it? And this five stage change process is fairly well embedded in most of the change literature these days. So this is not mine. This is kind of a universal process. Before you get to think about it, you start to consider it. Do I need the change, and what's it going to cost me? And guys, most of us know we've been in that situation, because it can be relate to any sinful behavior. And then the preparation. And there's a lot of preparation involved if you're going to give up an addiction. Because at that preparation stage, you have to engage people with you. You have to take steps, and we're going to talk about the steps, the factors that fit into this in just a moment. Because you just don't make the decision and it happens. There's a fair bit of preparation that has to go into that. Many guys go, well, I can do it by myself. I've got strong enough will to be able to give it up. And I gently remind them that it wasn't strong enough not to start, and now they've been involved in it, it's going to be 10 times, 100 times more difficult to give it up than it was to stop starting. You know, I think the scriptural idea is flee sinfulness. You know, any form of evil, get away from it. Why? Because it's going to be easier to do that than it is to get out the other end. And then there's the action steps. And part of any addictive procedure or any recovery from addiction will always have to look at the question of maintenance. Because one of the major problems we have with addiction recovery is relapse or regression, whatever way you want to look at it. But it's where a person says, yeah, I've gone for 6 months, I haven't had a drink, so I deserve one now. It's a reward. Or, I haven't been on the net for 3 months, and I've got the nanny net on there, so net nanny on, so I can't see anything. But gee, you know, I think I'll go to the Bucks party, because it's someone, and I'm just there, so if they show something, it's not my fault. You know, and so I've gone this month, I know it's not a problem now, I can walk away from it. And the first step on the slippery slope begins again, you know. And we used to have, when I was working drug and alcohol units, we used to say it takes 7 hits by a salesman to sell you an article, door-to-door salesman sort of talk. It takes at least that many admissions for a person to admit that they have no control over their addiction. And if you've ever been involved in AA or you know about it, that's the first step. So it often means you keep returning to that first step because it's a powerful issue you're dealing with. That's why it's called addiction, where you're willing to pursue it and repeat it no matter what the cost. So the idea of returning and relapse is a huge problem in addictive recovery. That's why I go with the second model, because unless you deal with the underlying issues of abandonment or entitlement, whatever is underneath there, it's always just going to keep coming back because the need is still there, and unless you meet the need with a legitimate method, they're always going to find artificial and substitutionary methods. And we'll look at now the change factors. Yeah, let me go back. It's A, B, C, D, E, F, by the way, if you're trying to put something together. And then I'll give them to you one at a time. Accountability. Basically, the addicted person cannot trust their own monitoring and regulatory systems. If you're an addict at anything, you have to admit, if you had control, you wouldn't be an addict. They need an objective scrutineer who has their interests at heart enough to confront them with their behaviours. So I recommend that they have what the AA people call a sponsor. That's fine, we'd call it what you like. But they need to have people to whom they are accountable and that they meet them weekly. Now, I find that when my clients start this, they go, oh, I haven't seen, you know, he was crook last week and I haven't, it's been 3 weeks. And I go, well, are you waiting for him to initiate or are you initiating? Because if you're initiating, you've had 21 days to do something. If you're waiting for him to initiate, it's not his problem. He's gifting you with his time and he's making you accountable. But you have to gift yourself by making that call and going and seeing him. This factor also includes disclosure to spouse and spiritual leadership. And in the case of those in AA programs, their peers. See, the choice is really up to the spouse. But they need to know before they can make the choice whether they're going to go or not. But don't fool, I mean, you can't fool your spouses. They will know there's something wrong. My clients often try and fool their spouses, and the spouses are, I knew there was something wrong. You just haven't been yourself. Or you've been drifting away for the last 2 years, or whatever. And remember, the leadership of your church is to provide the support, not only for you, but your spouse. So disclosure means accountability. So I tell the men with whom I work, they need to tell their spouse, bring them in, come in together and we'll do it together if necessary. They need to tell their spiritual leadership so they can get support. I've never yet had someone thrown out of their church because they've gone and disclosed and said, I want some help. The church has often said, okay, this elder will become part of your accountability team. And if it's been the pastor, he's gone to his team and they said, well, we'll have to put some boundaries around your access and so on. And I had a couple of school principals who actually had to resign. But they found their church was accepting and able to stay with them during the process of change and healing. And the counsellor who they see, or you, their best friend, is another pathway for accountability. But they must be accountable because they can't trust their own monitoring and regulatory systems. Access to the addictive object must be restricted. If they're addicted to a person, a relationship, they have to be weaned off that. They've got to be restricted. If they've been on the net, and it's pornography that basically is the problem here. They need some sort of net nanny put onto their computer, something that's going to block the sites. Opportunities at work and internet cafes and so on are harder to monitor and will usually only become more restricted when the person gets into that self-directed change mode. I had a client who was working at the university and had night classes that he taught. But he didn't teach night classes 5 nights a week. The rest of those nights he was down at Star City, gambling. And there was no way that could be monitored until we found out his work schedule, and so he had to be home by a certain time so that there could be an accountability that was brought into bear on that. But until he was willing to disclose and say what was happening and give us the schedule, it wasn't going to happen. Because there's enough internet cafes and there are enough computers around the place for a person to be able to access. But once they see that there are other ways of meeting those needs of being special and being in charge and being in control, which you can do. I mean, if you're watching a video screen and you can get the girl on the other end of that screen or in that screen to do anything you want, and you don't have to do anything, you've already just paid your money. Control comes back, your sexuality comes back. But it's a very, very poor substitute for a real relationship, and that's the thing that will get people turned around. So boundaries need to be restricted. Lost time and trips are another area that need to be addressed and somehow found to be accountable. And often I will say, don't go anywhere without a companion. Billy Graham was never in a room with a woman other than his wife unless he had a staff member present. Ravi Zacharias will not travel outside of his home state overnight unless he has a traveling companion with him. He doesn't want to be accused of anything. These men have integrity and they know their limits and they know that it's better to be wise than sorry. Consequences. You must have consequences. For so long, a person gets into an addictive behavior pattern and they don't have consequences. So that just reinforces it. I can do this. Wife's gone out shopping with a mother or something. Click, 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 click. I've got 30 minutes. And that happens. Everybody goes home, stay at work. Click, click, click. No consequences. However, once there's disclosure and they realize the consequences are not necessarily coming from others, they wear the consequences in their own spiritual and relational and often physiological selves, then they start to move into that self-directed change pattern. But both the addict and those to whom they're accountable need to agree on the costs of relapse. You do this one more time and I'm gone. They need to agree that so that the addict knows and those people that are in consequence or looking after the consequences know. You do this one more time, you'll be barred from the fellowship. Or you can't do this and you can't do that. It has to be agreed on beforehand. It's not something you negotiate. Everybody must agree. No changes to the consequences are to be made without the consent of all parties. I've got to go overseas for 3 weeks. Okay, then we'll agree that you can go. But If we've agreed you can't go, one of the consequences is no overseas trips, you're going to have to say no. But if you really feel you cannot without jeopardising the future of your firm, whatever, then it has to be agreed. Otherwise, you don't go. Maybe the consequence is you lose your job. The consequences have to be laid out and agreed upon. The dynamics. This is where I spend most of my time. Because the underlying dynamics need to be identified and understood, really, if the addict is to be able to identify those dangerous emotions and relational triggers. You know, they need to know what it was in their background. They need to know what it was that created that. One very prominent author in this area says that overcoming addictions is a matter of growing up. Taking responsibility for yourself and your own actions. And I found that most cyber sex addicts are actually living out adolescent fantasies. They haven't grown past their adolescence. They're still wanting to individuate. They're still wanting to be proving that they can do things that their parents won't let them do. But now the parent is the church, or the parent is God, or the parent is the spouse. And they're proving their individuality. You can't tell me what to do. And they're like 12 and 13-year-olds. So they have to work through their adolescence now on an adult and spiritual plane. Okay? And most sexuality problems have their roots back when we were struggling with what our sexuality was. It never got resolved, and it keeps coming up. I like to think of it, I don't like to think of it, but it's the picture that comes to me is trying to keep ping pong balls underwater. You know? Unless you drain the tub, they're always just going to keep popping up, even though you put all the energy in to keep them underwater. And so these underlying dynamics need to be dealt with so you can remove them. Enrichment. This is important. The enrichment of the addict's life with real relationships, real solutions, real emotional regulation, etc., is the key to real recovery. You have to put back into your life that which enriches it, not that which drains it and disempowers it. And perhaps the key to long-term resolution is this idea of enrichment. Substitution has been the name. All of these are substitutes for real life relationships, real life or real ways of meeting legitimately those legitimate needs. The addiction has become a substitute for the inner need, and in the case of the cybersect addict, a safe, undemanding and available way of fulfilling their fantasies. But it doesn't meet the need of relationship, of bonding, of giving as well as receiving. And so to enrich with real relationships is the key. So while you're working on their problem, you have to be working on what it is that's relating. Listening to the Clarks talk. And they talked about what I think Amelia was talking about. One of the differences, men have sex to feel good about themselves, and women have sex when they feel good about themselves. Think of it another way here, and this goes back years. I heard Brian Willisdorf tell me this when I was a little kid. Men will give a little love to get a little sex. Women will give a little sex to get a little love. And that's a big difference, you see. And so real love has to be thought through. Sex is a very poor substitute. Artificial sex is a very poor substitute for real love, of which sex is a part. So we've got to be working on the realities of their life and not isolating them from the legitimate ways of meeting their needs. And the faith factor is the most significant, since it's through the spiritual connection with their Creator God and within their faith community that the addict deals with their emotional struggles. The faith factor and the emotional struggles are huge, because it's the issues of guilt, shame, failure, worthlessness, the sins of the flesh, the lust of the eye, the pride of life. These are the things that drive the addictions. And it's only when we're connected with our God and we understand forgiveness and we understand repentance and restoration and grace, and that not only comes from God but comes from our faith community. If we can't understand grace and be able to receive forgiveness and forgive ourselves and then understand that Christian spiritual maturity is a relationship, then we're not going to get wholeness. We may get over an addiction, but we won't have the needs met that these addictions are driving. So faith is really the basic issue. Who we are, with whom we belong, how do we get our needs met from our God and our faith community? See, there's no one relationship that will meet all your relationship needs. It's part of the error, I think, in a lot of Christian teaching in the church. Get married and you've got to meet all your wife's needs. You can't. You know, she needs her girlfriends. She needs the women. She needs her family. You need your mates. You need your family. You need your faith community to have your needs met. One person can't do it. God's designed us that way. But he's the one it starts with. Now, in the US, and I think it's out here too, there's, instead of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's called Alcoholics Victorious. It's a Christian group, and there's variations on it. And they start with this, that God's grace can be extended to you in any condition. Whether you're an alcoholic or a cyber sex addict, or whether you're just addicted to chocolate. I've got a textbook we use at college, and it's called Addictions, Sex, Drugs, and Chocolate. And anything that we repeatedly pursue at any cost. All right? Thank you. Thank you.